This is All In. I'm Matt Pilser. It's our Friday pitch-in where we spend the hour on a few different topics, not just one. Coming up, new research out of IU compares dust samples from homes taken before the pandemic and compares them to those taken more recently. They looked for potentially harmful disinfectant residue, since we're all cleaning a lot more now. They'll share their results, as well as alternatives to some of those more harmful chemicals. And on this anniversary of the 9/11 terror attacks, my conversation with the executive director of the Indiana War Memorials Commission, who manages the Indiana 9/11 Memorial. But first, a look at Indiana's biggest headlines from this past week with our Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer, Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
Well, let's start with the COVID-19 numbers. What was the week like?
Yeah, so as of noon today, 3,196 people have died from COVID-19, have confirmed died from COVID-19. There are nearly 103,000 confirmed deaths and more than 1.6...
Cases, rather, not deaths. Sorry.
Oh, geez, thank you. Confirmed cases and more than 1.6 million Hoosiers have been tested. So that's 69 new deaths from last week, an increase of about 5,000 new cases. Over the course of the last week, which, to kind of put that in context, the 3 weeks previous to this last one, those increases have been around the 7,000 range. So today, the state reported 1,282 new deaths. That breaks the record for single day reporting. The previous record was August 6th.
Or rather, new cases, not new deaths. Sorry.
Thank you.
There's a lot of numbers, a lot of numbers coming at us.
It's a lot of numbers. There's been a bit of a dip in new reported positive cases because of the holiday weekend. But based on some of the positivity rates that we're seeing, some of the newly reported cases that we're seeing, it's pretty likely that we will level back up to about that 7,000 new cases a week.
So are you saying that this week being down by about 2,000 is does it seem somewhat anomalous?
I mean, it's I mean, it's because of the holiday weekend, right?
Like,
if you are out and about doing grilling, doing things that maybe you shouldn't be doing in the middle of a pandemic, you're not very likely to go through a drive-through test to make sure that you don't have the coronavirus. So testing decreases a little bit, and then the reported cases also then dip because you have fewer people who are going to get tested.
Okay, so we'll look, we'll compare to next week as well, and we'll maybe do a two-week average or something like that. So the lost wages assistance funding coming down from the federal government, what do we know about how it's getting to Hoosiers?
Yeah, so the Department of Workforce Development says it's on track to begin issuing that extra $300 payments to unemployed Hoosiers on September 21st. However, there are still many unemployed folks who won't get federal lost wages assistance funds. Per the White House guidelines, Hoosiers who have to be approved to receive at least $100 of unemployment benefits in order to get the extra $300. DWD estimates that means roughly 17% of those on the state's unemployment program, somewhere between 25,000 to 30,000 Hoosiers each week, don't receive enough from the state's unemployment insurance program to actually be eligible. For many unemployed workers who are eligible for lost wages assistance, Indiana is currently approved to pay up to 6 weeks of extra benefits retroactively, backdated to the week ending August 1st. However, the day after this Department of Workforce Development announced that they were getting that $300 extra benefit up and running, FEMA, who is part of the federal infrastructure for getting that money to Indiana, said Thursday that states, including Indiana, should plan for a maximum of 6 weeks of boosted unemployment benefits of $300 per week. Of course, the day after the state said it actually expects payments to begin. A FEMA spokesperson said in a statement the decision to cap the program at 6 weeks was based off on state and U.S. Department of Labor spending projections. It said it's already distributed $30 billion of the $44 billion set aside for the program.
Okay. And when we look at substitute teaching in Indiana, some schools seem to be concerned about how many they've got at the ready.
Yeah. So substitute teachers have been in demand for a while, and a lot of school districts have a critically short supply. As many school districts are trying to provide some sort of in-person instructions, school leaders say that shortage of teachers could force them to once again move students online. For example, Frontier School Corporation Superintendent Dan Sichting says his corporation employs 50 certified teachers and has just 5 substitutes on hand this fall, but only 2 of them are available to work at the junior-senior high school. He says shortages have meant closing things like the school library or the computer lab for the day while existing staff are trying to fill in. And in Beech Grove, Beech Grove High School principal Liz Walters says solutions she and other leaders have looked to for temporary relief in the past are wearing thin. Teachers have given up their prep time to cover classes and crunch before, but she said things have intensified this year and it's not fair or feasible to ask teachers to regularly give up the small amount of time they have during the day to get ready for classes they usually teach. State leaders have urged schools to at least prepare for return to online learning as the fallout from the ongoing pandemic continues. And Walters said she and others have prepared to move online in case local health departments have to close schools because of the spread of COVID-19 in their communities. But the start of the flu season is here, and school leaders told Jeannie Lindsay spoke to said they're already thinking about whether or not they will need to shift to online learning if they don't find qualified staff soon.
And is there anything in Jeannie's reporting as to why there is a shortage? I would imagine, I guess, it's just concerns over COVID-19, but is there something else?
There's a lot of your substitute teachers and temporary staff are older teachers who may have retired early. I have a couple of instances of that in my own family, actually. And there's also the concern about pay. Like, Indiana does not necessarily have competitive pay compared to other neighboring states. And so if I'm a teacher and I have the opportunity to move to Indiana or Illinois or Michigan or Ohio, I might select one of our neighbors instead of Indiana because I'm going to make more bang for my buck.
And we'll see if changes come next year, as there have been many promises to address that, next year being a budget year. But of course, those promises were made pre-pandemic. We will see what happens indeed. All right. So let's look at the payroll tax deferral that came down from the president. This was an option. Well, I don't think it's an option for federal employees. I think it's happening for federal employees. As I understand it, it's being recommended for state employees. But what's the governor saying to it?
Yeah. Governor Eric Holcomb says no. Thanks, but no thanks. Indiana will not participate in the payroll tax deferral for state workers offered by President Donald Trump last month. The Trump executive order allows employers to push back payroll taxes from September through the end of December for employees making less than $4,000 every 2 weeks. But Governor Eric Holcomb said it's a delay and would just mean doubling up in January. Trump officials have floated the idea of forgiving those deferred taxes entirely, but Congress would need to approve such a move, and it's really unclear whether or not it would do so.
Yeah, I wouldn't see a situation where the governor would disagree if the forgiving of those taxes were to happen. But it sounds like what this plan does is it just kind of takes them away for now and then doubles things up at the beginning of next year.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So one of the longest serving senators in the Indiana State Legislature is going to retire. He announced this when?
Monday. Or no, he announced Tuesday.
Oh, Tuesday. It wasn't on the holiday.
No,
so who are we talking about?
We are talking about State Senator Jim Merritt. He represents parts of Marion and Hamilton counties. His 30-year tenure makes him the longest-serving current Republican state senator. There have certainly been longer-serving senators in the grand history of the Indiana General Assembly. That all being said, he's the longest-serving caucus chairman in the history of the Indiana General Assembly, as well as the chair of the Senate Utilities Committee. He announced that he will step down on November 4th, the day after the election. And a private Republican caucus will choose Merritt's replacement to serve out the last 2 years of his term. That person will actually become the 14th legislator sent to the state house by a private caucus in the last 4 years.
And as I understand, this retirement came as a bit of a surprise.
Yeah. Marion County Democrats, good gracious, the Marion County Republicans actually said in their statement that they were totally surprised by Merritt's decision. And he actually mentioned to some other media outlets that he was interested in looking at other state positions, that he was kind of trying to open up his options and wasn't going to be able to do so while still serving in the Senate.
Oh, okay. Was there any speculation as to what offices he might be looking at?
Yes, and I'm trying to find Brandon's tweet.
Brandon Smith, our State House reporter, always on top of it, indeed.
Especially on his day off. He was supposed to be off on Tuesday and instead was tweeting about it.
Now, that is Brandon, if I know Brandon. And,
yes,
of course, you can hear Brandon on Indiana Week in Review on some of these stations tonight at 6 p.m., especially our flagship station WFYI, mm-hmm, and also WBAA in Lafayette. So what did Brandon tweet?
There's four statewide offices up in 2022 when Merritt's Senate term would end. So that's U.S. Senate, which is held by Republican Todd Young, Secretary of State, which Brandon notes is open, State Treasurer, which is again open, and Auditor, which is held by Republican Tara Klutz. So there's something interesting that Merritt seems to be working on for the future.
Okay. Well, he's been at it for a long time, so we also wouldn't be surprised, I guess, if he just said he was done and said that was retirement for him. Well, let's look at the Indiana 2022 way. We've got a couple seconds to just talk about that.
Yeah.
We're talking about elections. We're talking about other things, too.
Yeah. And we've got a whole video series on our YouTube page. We've got a whole we're doing a lot. So please text elections to 73224 in order to join the Indiana 2022 way. Of course, we're covering COVID. But like I said, in the little more than 6 weeks leading up to the election, we are focusing on election specific topics. So if you send us those questions, they may inform some of the short explainer videos. And next Wednesday, I am hosting a conversation on our Facebook page and other Indiana Public Broadcasting Facebook pages across the state about how to basically research candidates.
All right. She's our digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting and our personal news maven here at All In. Lauren, thanks.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Up next, what are quaternary ammonium compounds? Whether you know the term or not, you can bet they're probably in your home. Why residue from disinfectants we're all generously applying now could be cause for concern. That's next in 90 seconds. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Most of us are doing our best to curb the spread of COVID-19, and that includes disinfecting surfaces. We're using many more disinfectants than usual, and while that does control the spread of the virus, it can also be filling our homes with potentially harmful residue that can cause a few adverse effects. The reason we're talking about this on our show is because some of the research on this is being done right here in Indiana. We're joined by two of the authors of the new study, Increased Indoor Exposure to Commonly Used Disinfectants During the COVID-19 Pandemic. Amina Salamova is a research scientist with IU's O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs. Amina, welcome.
Hello.
And Gabe Filippelli is professor of earth sciences and the director for the Center for Urban Health at IUPUI. Gabe, great to have you back on the show.
Nice to be back, Matt.
So, Amina, I'll start with you. Why'd you want to look into this?
So, Matt, this idea really came during the pandemic. This is a global pandemic, and we were all required to clean a lot and disinfect a lot. We are always indoors. So this is really a routine that has become usual in our homes starting from the start of the pandemic. Since we're using a lot of chemicals during this time, I'm an environmental chemist. So I started thinking, what kind of chemicals are used in the products that we've been using so much from the start of the pandemic? And I started looking into this, and it turns out that this is a group of chemicals. There is hundreds of chemicals that was included in this group, and these are called quaternary ammonium compounds, or QAQs. Some people call them QAQs. They are used extensively in the everyday disinfecting products that we use in our homes. And as I started looking more into this, I found out that some of these chemicals could be quite toxic. There is a limited information on this, how we're exposed and what are the exact toxic effects. But again, some of these chemicals can really have adverse effects on our respiratory systems, reproductive systems. Some of them can be skin irritants. And some of them are even called asthmogens, as they can trigger asthma, especially in occupational settings.
What do we know about, I don't know, I guess the dosage on these QAQs to get to a point, I guess, where they could really have adverse effects? Or is there not really a lot of information out there on that?
There is really not much information on this. The toxicity of these chemicals, especially human toxicity, is really being developed. There is really not many groups or studies that have looked into this. So, yeah, we don't know much about the dosage.
I mean, are you alarmed at the amount of these chemicals that are out there? Or really, I guess, if used responsibly, do you agree that they are safe?
All products that we use in our homes should be used in safe ways. I always advocate using products, especially containing chemicals, in a safe way, following the instructions on the labels of the products. I believe that if we don't overuse these chemicals and use them only when we need to, it can be safe, but you have to be careful about doing this. There are some specific things that you can do in your home to be on the safer side. First of all, like I mentioned, follow the instructions on the label. Wear gloves when you use these chemicals. Also, don't overuse them. You don't have to disinfect everything in your home. You just have to disinfect high-touch surfaces. And also, there are quite a few options, alternatives to products that contain QAQs, substances like alcohol, for example, or hydrogen peroxide can be used instead of products containing QAQs.
So what kinds of disinfectants use quaternary ammonium compounds? You don't have to mention brand names, but if you mm-hmm. do, that might be helpful. What are we looking at?
There are many, many products in which QAQs are used. So there is a list of chemicals or products which was issued by the Environmental Protection Agency, which is called List N. And the list includes about 400 different products that can be effective for the coronavirus. About 200 of these products contain QAQs. These are used in many brands that you can see in many stores. These are used both in sprays and in wipes.
Is there, I guess, by your measure, a safer way to use products with QAQs over others? I mean, I think of sprays and you think of droplets in the air, or maybe that would have a little bit more contact with some of the dust particles, which is kind of a lot of what your study looked at. Or is it all kind of lumped into the same group?
What we found in our study, we, along with dust, we also analyzed several products that can be commonly found in our homes. And what we found that wipes actually have much higher levels of QAQs than sprays. So, moderate use of sprays could be better in terms of, leaching out and partitioning to dust and into indoor air. Also, when you use these products, it is really best, if possible, to ventilate the rooms in which these are used. So ventilate your home as much as possible to sort of dilute the indoor air and get these chemicals out.
I use disinfectant wipes all the time. I do not ventilate. I do not use gloves. So this is a very useful conversation for me right now. Gabe Filippelli, how did you help out here on this study?
Well, it's interesting, Matt. I've run a citizen science program for a couple years now
where we invite people to send in samples of their indoor dust. So they just vacuum their house and they send their dust in. And we analyze that dust and provide results back to the homeowners. And the purpose of this is that we spent a tremendous amount of time inside, and obviously during the pandemic, we spent even more so. And we know very little about what's called the exposome, the indoor exposome. So what are you being exposed to inside the house? So I've commonly used these samples, these citizen science samples, to analyze for heavy metals, things like lead in dust, which can be a real problem, obviously, if you have children. But happily, Amina reached out to me wondering about whether I happen to have some samples from around central Indiana that I've received before the pandemic. And lo and behold, I did. And I shared the samples with Amina and her student. And so I was able to kind of share in the partnership that way. But, you know, all of the science here is all Amina's. So it's been fun to see a program designed for something completely different be utilized for another branch of scientific research.
Okay, well, let's take a quick look at some of the things that you found with the samples before we got to this study. I mean, can you share the quick version of what you found on the heavy metals front on the samples that you had collected prior?
Sure. We found that there's a pretty large range in the amount of heavy metals, ranging from predominantly safe values. I would say 80% of the samples we had are safe values for indoor dust. And about 10% of them are kind of marginal. And unfortunately, 10% of them far exceed any kind of safety standard. And we think that that's largely because that small 10% were either homes that had a significant amount of lead paint in them, and this is the case for lead, or their outside environment was very enriched with lead. And about 60% of the dust in your home actually comes from outside. So that becomes a pretty important shuttle for the interior exposome. And so for those houses that were particularly problematic, we reached out to individual homeowners and gave them special instructions beyond the normal.
We're talking to the authors of a new study, Increased Indoor Exposure to Commonly Used Disinfectants During the COVID-19 Pandemic. Gabe Filippelli is a professor of earth sciences at IUPUI, and Amina Salamova is a research scientist with IU's O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs. So, Amina, when you looked at these dust samples that Gabe provided and that you also looked at, Gabe provided some dust samples from pre-pandemic, and you also looked at some dust samples post-pandemic. When you looked at the two, how did they compare?
You're absolutely correct. Gabe gave us several samples collected pre-pandemic from central Indiana, and they collected about 40 dust samples collected during pandemic here in Bloomington and nearby. And what we found was really surprising to us, that the levels of quarks measured in samples collected during the pandemic were almost double of those measured in the dust samples collected pre-pandemic, which really indicates that, quarks are being used more and they partition to the indoor dust.
Did you find quarks in all of the dust samples pre and post-pandemic? It was just the levels that kind of differed quite a bit?
Yes. We've looked at about 19 different quarks, and the majority of them were found in almost all dust samples collected before and during the pandemic.
Was any of that surprising to you?
This was really my first experience with quarks, and I was really surprised to find them in each and every dust sample. That was probably the most surprising finding to me, because there is really no previous information on how we're exposed to dust. No one has measured them in indoor air or indoor dust. So that was surprising to me to find them so abundant in our homes.
So you're kind of breaking some new ground with this study. No one's looked at this really before?
Yes, I was also surprised to see that these are the chemicals that have been used for decades in very high volumes in the United States. Some of them are used in volumes more than 1 million pounds per year. And no one has looked at the major human exposure pathways, we don't know how we are exposed. Are we exposed through the inhalation, through air? Are we exposed through ingestion of dust in our homes? We don't know.
So from a public and environmental health perspective, should we be looking closer at these quaternary ammonium compounds since their use is really, really increasing amid the COVID-19 pandemic? Should we know more about these before we say, hey, use these generously in your homes?
Yes, I think we absolutely should. We should be careful about the chemicals we use in our homes. We know now that the chemicals that we use in our homes, not only in cleaning products, but in other consumer products that we use, even in furniture and, you know, electronics, carpets, chemicals that are used in these products get into the indoor air, get into the indoor dust, and eventually get into our bodies. So we should be absolutely careful with what we're using in our homes, and especially with clocks now, because the use has increased significantly and is expected actually to go up as well, not only in the United States, but also worldwide. We should be careful with this.
So, Amina, we've touched on this a little bit before, but mm-hmm. some people might be hearing this and thinking, well, I can't just not disinfect. So mm-hmm. how can they utilize these products safely, or what could they be using instead?
So there are a few safer alternatives for quarks. Alcohol, either ethanol or isopropyl alcohol, is a safer alternative and is also as effective against the novel coronavirus as the quarks. Hydrogen peroxide is another alternative. And there are products which have alcohol or hydrogen peroxide as the major component. Cleaning and disinfecting products. And also, like I mentioned before, if you choose to use quarks, just be careful and follow the label on the product. Don't overuse it in your home. Gabe, just use where it's needed.
Gabe Filippelli, would you say there's enough information out there about this sort of common chemical exposure in homes?
No, there really isn't. We've spent a lot of time providing information and guidelines for what's called occupational exposure. So in your workplace, for example, how much there's allowable limits for all kinds of things that are set by OSHA, which is a federal oversight arm. But it ends in the occupational realm. Inside people's homes, it's a black box, Matt. We really have very little understanding of what's inside folks' homes. And you know, barring visiting everyone's home in the country as researchers, that's why we started the citizen science approach. When people vacuum their homes, they don't necessarily vacuum every surface, obviously, but they vacuum enough of it that we get a sampling of what their indoor exposome is. And I think that's what Amina's, when she's talking about, we don't exactly know the safe levels. Well, we don't exactly know because we didn't even before now know what the levels were inside people's homes. So that's where I see a lot of the exposure, what's called exposure science, going is the indoor exposure.
But can we take the data that we've collected and take what we've learned from measuring the levels of some of these toxins in the workplace, and can we apply that to a home environment, or are there just too many differing variables there? Do we really need to kind of measure the home environment independent of the workplace environment?
Well, probably the same health metrics can be used for both, right? Because it's the OSHA, the occupational guidelines are about exposure and uptake risks, right? So you could probably use the same math, but without knowing what's inside people's homes, you don't know what to be concerned about. So for example, our findings of a significant amount of lead and zinc inside people's homes makes you wonder if we're under protecting people's health. You know, when you sell a house or when a property is transferred, there's often some requirement to do lead testing of soils outside the home, not of inside the home, which is really puzzling. And so that's where I see the fact that I think we're partway there, except without knowing what's inside people's homes, where we spend a tremendous amount of time, 70-80%, we don't really know what to be concerned about and what not to be concerned about.
Amina, this is really important work, and very, very cool that you've kind of broken this ground on this subject. Do you plan to follow up on this at all?
Yes, absolutely. We are following up on this research right now, actually. And my what we're doing, we would like to see how these chemicals get into our bodies and what are the internal levels or internal dose of these chemicals, if any, in people's bodies that are being exposed. So we have developed methods to measure these chemicals in blood. And that's what we're doing right now. Another plan is to try to measure these chemicals in blood samples that were collected during the pandemic and compare the levels to blood collected before the pandemic to see if these chemicals inside our bodies, if the levels are going up and how they can affect our health.
Amina Salamova is a research scientist with IU's O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs, and she co-authored the new study, Increased Indoor Exposure to Commonly Used Disinfectants During the COVID-19 Pandemic. So, Amina, thanks for your work, and thanks for taking the time to explain it for us.
Thank you for having me back.
And Gabe Filippelli is also one of the study's co-authors and a professor of earth sciences, as well as the director for the Center for Urban Health at IUPUI. Gabe, thank you.
Always a pleasure, man.
Up next, on this 19th anniversary of the 9/11 terror attacks, the story of the Indiana 9/11 Memorial from the man in charge. I'm Matt Pelser. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today, of course, marks a somber anniversary, 19 years since the 9/11 terror attacks. On the 10th anniversary, Indiana dedicated its own memorial to that day. And as we look ahead at the big 20-year mark next year, we thought we'd get some backstory on what it took to dedicate the memorial, which you can find in downtown Indianapolis. I'm here with General J. Stuart Goodwin, Executive Director of the Indiana War Memorials Commission. Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon.
So as I understand it, this story kind of starts about 10 and a half years ago when the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey offered up World Trade Center artifacts for communities so that they could dedicate their own memorials. So what happened next?
Well, it's the story started with some concerned business people, and they decided they were going to raise some money and try to put this memorial together. And that's exactly what they did. We got involved from the standpoint that they wanted to have the dedication ceremony for the steel once it came into Indiana, and we said we'd be happy to help.
And so the Indiana War Memorials Commission got involved, and what did that look like?
Well, basically, the first thing they did was that they wanted to have the dedication ceremony here. And they talked to us maybe 10 days, 2 weeks before the event, and said they were going to have the steel come from New Jersey down I-70, and they wanted to stop in Richmond, and the Indiana State Police would escort the steel back here to Indianapolis. And they wanted to have it out front here in our building and on Michigan Street, on East Michigan Street. And very casually, they said, there's going to be some motorcycles that are going to come with it. And I said, really, how many? Well, maybe 3,000. And I thought, well, that's an interesting thing to worry about now. And so the days went by and we started to talk about different things and what they wanted to do. And the momentum started to build with this because it was going to be for the 10th anniversary. And so every day they'd call or we'd have a meeting, and then 3,000 motorcycles went to 4,500, 5,000 motorcycles. And I remember it was probably two or three days before the event. The guy said, well, General, I think maybe there might be as many as 8,000 to 9,000 motorcycles. And I almost lost my mind. I mean, I didn't show any emotion, but I thought, oh my gosh, where are we going to put all these motorcycles? Well, on the day of the event, and I'll never forget this as long as I live, in the military around a flying operation, you talk about weather when the ducks are walking. In other words, the weather's just really kind of crappy. And so it was one of those days. And the steel came down 70. They stopped in Richmond. The escort picked them up. And what happened, Matt, was that when the steel came and parked in front of the war memorial with the police and all the escort, there were still motorcycles in Richmond that had not left.
50-plus miles away.
58 miles away. And so with the help of IMPD and a lot of other volunteers, we got them parked. And it was truly a day I will never forget, because the people that were there, that were out in the weather, it was gloomy, it was overcast. And when the steel came in on the semi, they were draped with the American flags. And they had multiple flags covering all of the steel. And when they parked them out front, the people just gathered around these trucks. And when we talked earlier, and it's happening again now, I get very emotional about what I saw, because I just wasn't expecting this at all. But people, they put their hands underneath the flag to touch the steel. And excuse me, but they were crying and they were praying. And I had never seen anybody or any situation where an inanimate object caused such a human reaction. And it just sent a really strong message about the fact that eventually we wanted to get some of that steel and put it in our museum. But what happened was that they shortly after that, they asked us, the Indiana War Memorial Commission, if we would take over the management of these properties, because that's what we do. We manage 25 acres of Indianapolis downtown area with military monuments. And so what happened was that we took it to the commission. There's a commissioner from each of the congressional districts, and the decision was made that we respectfully declined that. And the reason for that was the fact that this was a first responders event. The brave, you know, men and women from police, fire, and emergency medical services, this was their event. And we just didn't feel, even at the 10-year point, that we had a legitimate seat at the table. And so when we told them that, they were disappointed, but we felt that we'd made the right decision. Well, they came back to us in 2016 and said, you know, hey, would you reconsider about managing these properties? We took it to the commission, and by that time, 5,000 of my military brothers and sisters had paid the ultimate price because of terrorism. And we felt that we did have a legitimate seat at the table, and so what we took over the management of the properties at that time, knowing that there was not very much there about the military. So a couple of years went by, and we obtained an 800-pound piece of limestone from the site. The Pentagon site. And so what we wanted to do was that we wanted to tie that together with the fact that the senior person killed that day, senior military person, was a Hoosier by the name of Lieutenant General Tim Maude. And he was a close personal friend of mine. I grew up with his family, worked with his dad and his sister. And so we thought that this would be a good way to tie that all together.
Can you tell me a little more about your friend who you lost on 9/11?
Sure. Tim was, first of all, just one of the most amazing jobs in the military, because personnel gets involved with just about everything. It'd be like HR when you know, for people that don't have a military background. And when you think about the fact that active duty, guard, and reserve, all of those duties and all of the personnel systems in the United States Army fell under Tim. And so it was one of those jobs where you just, you know, you never have an easy day, because you're always putting out fires. And he was the perfect guy for that, because he had such a great temperament, and he was a very smart individual, but he had the great people skills to go along with it. And so one of the things that we thought would be appropriate is, because he is a Hoosier and he was the senior person killed that day, that this is something we don't want to forget. And we don't want to forget any of this, because this was our Pearl Harbor. this was a situation where, you know, back in 1941, I can remember hearing my grandparents and my dad, who was a World War II vet, talking about the fact that, you know, it was surreal. I mean, to think that a foreign nation would attack a territory of the United States, it just, you never think about that. And I think that most people before 9/11 would have never thought that a foreign entity, whether it was a national or just a bunch of terrorists, that they would fly airplanes into, you know, some of the tallest buildings that we have in our land. And so it was an impact about the fact that, you know, it didn't matter if you were a Republican or a Democrat. It didn't matter what chromosome you had. It doesn't matter what the color of your skin was. Those that were around, and I'm sure that there's people listening today that will remember, you know, I've yet to come across an adult that say, do you remember where you were on 9/11? And every one of them knows exactly, well, I was doing this or I was doing that. But what it did for a very short period of time, unfortunately, is that we were Americans. You know, we didn't have all these other barriers, or we didn't have all these things that were put up in front of us to keep us to be different. We were all pulling on the rope at the same way. And that's really what this monument needs to do, is to remind us of those areas. You know, when you think about 11,000 motorcycles, you know, traveling the 58 miles, you don't see that every day. And the fact is that wherever your listeners were from, I'm sure they remember the pickup trucks with the flags, you know, stuck in the back of the pickup and driving through town and horns blowing. It was and no airplanes. It was so quiet because we didn't have any airplanes. You know, I have a real quick story, if you don't mind. I was the chief of staff at the Indiana Air National Guard. We had two F-16 wings, and we had jets in the air within hours. And so on the second day, they had the radars turned up, and nothing was supposed to fly except the military people. And we had a special transponder code to put into the jets. And so they got a call about an unidentified aircraft that was flying up near Roanoke, Indiana. And so, they scrambled two Vipers, two F-16s up there, and they're looking around, and lo and behold, they see an ultralight. And of course, you know, they can't get too close to him because they'll bounce him out of the sky. And so they're far enough away, and they're trying to wave and, you know, point down and that kind of business. And, you know, the guy's just out there punching holes in the sky. And eventually I think they want me to land. So he goes and he goes back and he lands. And the sheriff in that county was notified. He met him. He was back on his farm. And, you know, I don't remember what his name was, Bob or Joe or Bill or whatever. And the sheriff says, you know, what are you doing? You know, you're not supposed to be flying. And this guy says, well, why? And, the story that I heard was the sheriff was kind of dumbfounded. He says, because of yesterday, because of what happened. And of course, this guy, you know, he's just out there, you know, making a living, working his farm. And he says, well, I haven't had the news on what happened.
And oh, my he says, goodness.
Oh, well, they had these attacks, and all these people died, and they're trying to figure out who it was and what they were doing. And the guy says, you know, I've been out here working the fields, and I just got my ultralight and decided to, you know, take a tour around the farm. And you would not believe those jets, those Air Force jets that I saw up in the air. And I personally thought, and this I hope this is not too distasteful, but you know, the guy is probably on Depends for a week or two, you know, just because of the fear of seeing those things, you know, coming that close to him. But, you know, there's stories like that. I could tell you several stories, but, you know, we had people calling us when I was the chief, and people calling up, and they were veterans. They said, we want to join. We want to come back in. We want to go fight somebody. You know, we got this, you know, just hold on here. Let us take care of what we're doing here. But what I think is most important about this is that in some small way, a couple things is what we're trying to accomplish here. We're trying to make sure that this story is never forgotten. We want to make sure that people understand why they live the way they live today. When you look back and you think about how you used to go to an airport, you just drive up to the front and walk in.
Sure.
Do that anymore. But you go to a professional sporting event, you now have to, you know, everything but, you know, a body search to get in. You have to have a plastic bag so they can see what's in there. You know, you can only take so many ounces of whatever on an airplane. And the reason that we live like that today is because of 9/11. And so these people, you know, and I, when we talked earlier, we talked about, you know, people that are in high school now, this is just another day to them. And they just accept the fact that we live the way we live, but they don't really understand why. And so one of the things that we want to do with this, obviously the first one that we talked about, we want to make sure that all three of these, you know, these different groups we talked about, police, fire, EMS, and we want to add and make sure that people know about the military side of it because of the 5,000 service members that we've lost during that time.
I'm here with General J. Stewart Goodwin, Executive Director of the Indiana War Memorials Commission, and we're talking about the Indiana 9/11 Memorial, which is in downtown Indianapolis. How often do you get to visit the memorial?
Well, it's one of our properties. I'm down there on a pretty regular basis. The 25 acres that we take care of, we have a couple remote locations, and the USS Indianapolis CA-35 Memorial, the 9/11 Memorial, and of course the circle belongs to us, so we go down there just about daily to go by, and it's really interesting to talk to people that you see down there because they all want to tell their story. Mm. And they want to know where they were, what, you know, this is what their emotions were, this is what you know, this is what I was doing on that particular day, and it's something that is very important that we do not lose that. You know, we've got ourselves into a situation here where people are kind of down on monuments and memorials, and the truth of the matter is that these are markers of our history, and there's been times in our history when we're human beings, we do things and they're not acceptable in today's time, but what they made us to where we are today, and to tear them down and to destroy them or to forget and cancel that part of our history is the wrong thing to do because it made us to who we are today, and hopefully it will make us better citizens in the future.
Let's talk about next year, the 20-year anniversary. It's hard to believe we'll be there. How do you plan to mark that? Do you plan to do anything special?
Well, absolutely. That's what this fundraising thing that we're doing is all about. We're trying to raise $450,000. We got about half of it raised at this point. And we have this 800-pound piece of limestone from the Pentagon, Indiana limestone, obviously, that we're going to put up. We're going to put up a recognition about General Maud. There's no flags down there, so we're going to put a state and a national flag up there. And we're going to expand it by – it's 30 feet wide. We're going to go 10 feet to the south. And then that will be – the plan is to raise this money, and then we'll start construction next spring. And then we'll have the dedication on the 20th anniversary.
Can you tell me about the survivor tree?
Yeah, absolutely. That general area was pretty much just devastated, and all of the trees were destroyed with the exception of one tree, and it's been designated as the survivor tree. And so what they've done is that they've taken – the people in New York have taken this tree, and they have saplings that come off of it, and so they are these saplings are available – and they've passed a law or some ordinance or something in New York City about the fact that an individual person cannot own one of these trees. It can only be owned by a city or some type of a governmental agency. And so one of these trees is coming to us, and we will plant that on the properties during the dedication next year.
General J. Stewart Goodwin is Executive Director of the Indiana War Memorials Commission, and they're in charge of the Indiana 9/11 Memorial, which you can find on Ohio Street in downtown Indianapolis across from the Indiana Historical Society. It's right off the canal there. General Goodwin, thanks for your work and thanks for your time today.
Well, I'm very grateful for this opportunity. And one of the things that we want to make sure people understand is that we are a statewide museum. We're interested in telling stories about ordinary Hoosiers who have done extraordinary things. We're open from 9 to 5, Wednesday through Sunday, and there's no admission charge. We're located at 55 East Michigan Street in Indianapolis, Indiana.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana for topic alerts and discussion. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.